Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories.
Don't warn that tyranny is always lurking just around the corner. You should reject these voices.
You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
But I want to say one thing to the American people.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all.
Outrageous conspiracy theories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Beard World Order. I am your co-host, Guillermo Jimenez of TracesOfReality.com, joined as always by James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, and this month, on the third mic, we've got our good friend Peter B. Collins of the Peter B. Collins Show, Processing Distortion, over on BowlingFrogsPost.com. Peter, welcome. How you doing?
It's great to be with you, bearded, bespectacled gentlemen, and I would add bald, but you're not there yet, Guillermo.
Almost. Might get there eventually.
You have a ways to go yet, young Padawan.
Well, it's good to talk to you. You know, I think people who are joining us in might be thinking, hey, where's Sibelle Edmonds? This looks like a BFP roundtable. But this is the Beard World. And actually, coincidentally, we are going to be starting that up pretty soon again. I think maybe even in the next couple of weeks, so by the time this is probably uploaded, you might be seeing a future roundtable with that as well. But anyway, well,
and
yeah.
Let me just mention that I have not yet gone public with my comments on Sibelle's new novel, The Lone Gladio. But I recently took a three-week break. I had some long plane flights. And once I started reading it, I really, really felt fascinated by it. And it operates on many levels. I think it's an excellent novel. A spy novel that compares to many in that genre. But those of us who know her story and know the way many elements of it are woven into the novel, because, of course, if she tried to publish it as nonfiction, she would probably be gagged again, can appreciate what she exposes in the book. And so I just want to recommend it to those who are watching today, because I think it's both a good read and something that helps explore some of the inner recesses of the deep state.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel the same way. I thought it was a great read. We did an interview on TOR with Sibelle a few weeks ago. I know James did a review recently on YouTube, a YouTube video on it. And no, absolutely. I think I'd want to echo what you said, Peter. I'd absolutely recommend people check this out. It's not only a good read, a good spy thriller, but it's absolutely very, very relevant. It's relevant to the discussion we're going to be having today, actually. I wanted to open up the same way we opened up last month, actually. I thought, why not keep it going with a link from Twitter here. I found this actually just before we started recording this a few hours ago, and it's by, this is a tweet by Jonathan Shannon, I think it's pronounced, also coincidentally with The Guardian, but this is a little funny, I thought. He says, "My favorite American holiday is the annual unveiling of our new enemy." And I like the way that was phrased, and I found it very appropriate. I mean, I guess we have no shortage of those these days. And of course, it's either Al-Qaeda or it's ISIS or the Islamic State. Or I guess I must have blinked for a moment, because now we have a new one, the Khorasan group or entity or what have you. So yeah, it's hard to keep track of all our enemies these days.
Well,
and
I want to give credit to Jon Stewart's Daily Show, because one of his comedy reporters took the Khorasan new introduction and said, "Oh well, they're passé. We now have a splinter group from Khorasan called I'll Kill You All," and then. There is subsequently, during the report, she breaks into breathlessly update herself that I'll Kill Y'all has splintered into something to the effect of gonna F you up. And, you know,
let's get right to the point, right? beat around the bush? Yeah.
I took a three-week break and I tried to unplug, but I couldn't resist really, you know, looking at the new product launch. And I'm not talking about the iPhone. And when Khorasan was introduced, I was like, wow, that's software that we never even heard about.
Right.
And I give credit to some good reporters who have exposed that there really isn't anything called Khorasan. that this is a concoction that comes from Langley or someplace like it.
Very much so, and they've tried to paint this as if it is, as you say, a splinter group off of al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda that's popped up in Syria somehow or other. But of course, people who have looked into it, I mean, even they are claiming it consists of about 50 fighters. So apparently we are supposed to change the very fundamental fabric of our society to combat this scary new boogeyman of 50 bearded turban men. So, you know, everyone better quake in their boots and give up any remaining civil liberties that they may have forgotten to scoop up over the past 12 or 13 years. It is ridiculous, but it is interesting how the unveiling of the annual unveiling of the enemy always takes place in September. It seems to be a September type event. So obviously a lot of psychological resonance there.
Wasn't it George Tenet or somebody back there who said, well, you know, you don't launch a new product in August when everybody's on vacation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is very much
fall
like,
line, right? Yeah,
it's
why
like
not?
The fall of 2002.
Yeah, yeah, and it can't. I mean, I obviously, it's not. I don't think it's a coincidence, but that's what it comes off as, maybe superficially. But I mean, yeah, the build up to the bombing, the latest round of bombing of Iraq, just you know, weeks before, and they've been talking about it. For a long time, for sure, but it really, really ramped up. You know, late August, early September, leading up to the anniversary of September 11th, and I it's hard for me to dismiss that as simply just a coincidence. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, no, I actually talked about this in a recent newsletter where I went back from the last, I think, last 5 years and documented every September what happened.
Yeah, there we have.
And going back to that ridiculous 9/11 Ground Zero mosque debacle that culminated around September 11th, I think 2009. And in 2010, there was some sort of elevated terror threat. In 2011, there was some, there was Benghazi and all of that. And it just goes back and, or that was 2012 maybe. But at any rate, every single year it happens around this time. And I think, I mean, there's something to it. It really, it's funny how these types of things never do crop up in July and August when everyone's on holiday. It always is when everyone's coming back to work. I mean, it's, there really is some fundamental psychology being played on here, and it unfortunately continues to work on at least a portion of the populace, the portion of the populace that still bothers to tune into the mainstream media. And this is something that I've pointed out a few times in some of my recent broadcasts as well, is that we now have a record low number of people who actually trust the mainstream media, which is a good thing. It's heading in the right direction, those numbers, because obviously whatever else you think of the last couple of decades, I think that the mainstream media has proven in spades that it is absolutely nothing other than a mouthpiece for the administration or whatever group happens to be in power at this particular moment. And anyone who thinks otherwise at this point is simply delusional.
Well, and I would make the case that whether you're talking about data collection and data mining by the government, the information that people self-report in social media, or the sophisticated market research that's used by major media organizations, 9/11 continues to pop as a pivot point for this generation of Americans and how they view foreign policy. And, you know, the security theater at the airports reinforces that you must be afraid that, you know, these people want to get us. And we have seen the hysteria generated by hawks in elected office from Dianne Feinstein to John McCain and Lindsey Graham that, you know, we hear that there is a dozen, no, there's 100, no, there are 200 Americans who have gone to Syria to fight. Well, I heard a very inaccurate reference to John Walker Lind in that context by Gwen Ifill on the PBS NewsHour. And like many of the Americans who may have gone to Syria to fight, John Lind went to Afghanistan before September 11th. And he had volunteered for the Army of the Nation of Afghanistan, which was then controlled by Mullah Omar and that faction of the Taliban. And he certainly was not aware of the events that transpired and certainly was not a decision maker Nevertheless, he was tarred as the American Taliban, and now we have people invoking him in a false reference to the idea of American jihadists who hate America and therefore take up arms against us, when in fact most, if not all, of these Americans alleged to be fighting with the Sunni extremists in Iraq and Syria went there to oppose the Assad government, not to take up arms against the U.S. and its allies.
Yeah, I assume that those numbers are inflated, but I couldn't tell you for sure. But speaking of inflated numbers, I actually wanted to go back to something that you mentioned, James, back to the psychology of all of this a little bit, because you mentioned something that I thought was interesting. You said that people are tuning out of the mainstream media; they're not as influenced, which I think is absolutely true. They're tuning out in droves. However, I did pick up on a couple of public opinion polls leading up to the bombing of Iraq. And so I wanted to get you guys' opinion on this. I mean, are they just making these numbers up? Are they just pulling them out of a hat? Or could they have been somewhat accurate, at least in that moment when the fear was at fever pitch? CNN was saying something crazy, like 90% of Americans were under the impression that ISIS was a legitimate threat and 70% supported the bombing. And they just seemed awfully high to me, again, inflated a bit. Or maybe that's what was an accurate reflection of American public at the time. Wanted to know what do you guys think about that?
You first, James.
Well, personally, I don't trust those types of poll numbers as far as I can throw them. But I mean, I don't live in the States, so I don't interact with people there on a daily basis. I don't have that kind of. I mean, the people that I interact with tend to be the people who know about my website, who tend to not believe this garbage anyway. So I think I have perhaps a skewed view of what the average American thinks about this. And I'm sure there are a large number, a depressingly large number, who do buy into the fear-mongering. But having said that, I really do think the momentum is shifting away from that. Mm. And it brings to mind the fact that I remember seeing a few even a month ago or more, when they were still just talking about the possibility of ramping up to some sort of bombing. And Sky News had a Twitter poll which indicated that 83% of respondents to this Twitter poll were in favor of bombing Syria and Iraq. And it was interesting. I mean, they had an infographic about that and everything all ready to go, as if it was, it's a propaganda campaign that's being led by, Murdoch and Sky News and all of these organizations. And it's so transparent when you see it for what it is. But I suppose if you were just there on Twitter, following Sky News breathlessly for the latest news, you might fall for that type of thing. I think is insidious about these types of poll numbers is that, to a certain extent, they become self-fulfilling prophecies. Okay, regardless of what's behind these numbers or how accurate they are, when people see them internally, subconsciously, I don't think it's a conscious process, but subconsciously people start to believe, the majority of people are in favor of this, and that does affect people's thinking. So it's a very insidious process, and I try to tune out of those types of poll numbers rather than.
Yeah, you answered my question, because that's what I thought you were going towards, was the idea that the idea of groupthink, basically, is that once someone sees those poll numbers, like, oh, okay, well, I guess I should be afraid, shouldn't I? And then it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy, rather. Peter, your thoughts?
Just today, and this is October 1st, ABC Washington Post released a poll, and it shows that support for the bombing of Iraq and Syria is at about 70%. The so-called boots on the ground question still draws less than a majority. And I didn't get to the part of the poll where they did a test question on, do you support bombing Dr. Evil? But for me, this idea of do you support bombing IS, and they haven't fully developed the character of al-Baghdadi into a super evil, iconic figure like Noriega, Saddam, and, go on down the list, Zarqawi. But it's easy to understand how easily misled the American people are. And this is Obama's greatest skill. They've announced that finally Ghani, the former World Bank consultant, now running Afghanistan with our support, signed the deal to retain nearly 10,000 American troops there after the promised withdrawal date at the end of this year. And Obama saluted it as a great day for the Afghan-U.S. partnership. and there is no voice of any consequence in the U.S. saying, wait a minute, you promised to get all of our troops out. There were no qualifiers. There was no asterisk to that commitment. And now you're reneging on it, and there's no consequence.
Just to pick up on something that you said there in passing about Zarqawi being on that list of boogeymen, for people who haven't seen my recent podcast on who's really behind ISIS, I just want to point out once again that Zarqawi was part, the subject of an admitted Pentagon PSYOP program that was targeted at the American population, of course, in complete contravention to all existing American laws, rules, and regulations. But what else is new? But an admitted Pentagon PSYOP operation in order to build Zarqawi up as a more important figure than he actually was, including, of course, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq group in general, which, of course, morphed into ISIS. So it is important to note that this creation of the boogeyman process, I mean, we have actual documents at Pentagon briefing notes and quotes from General Kimmel and others who were intimately involved in this PSYOP operation, admitting it was a Pentagon PSYOP operation to make these types of people seem more important than they really were. They had their own justifications for that, but of course we all know that at least partial justification for that was just to justify the continuing, at that time, American presence in Iraq, and we would be naive to think otherwise. And once we start seeing the rollout of the propaganda campaign that's going to build Baghdadi up into the next boogeyman, I think we have to keep that that documented history in mind.
And if I may, my bearded friends, I would like to acknowledge a serious mistake that I made and that I have compounded for years now. I've argued that Bush's surge in Iraq was a complete failure. And I was wrong, because they're still surging. These are the Sunnis that we called the Sunni Awakening. And some of them had come out of American-controlled prisons after the de-bathification blunder of Paul Bremer during the occupation of Iraq. And so we gave them uniforms and guns and lots of American cash, not to shoot us, and to try to pacify Anbar in particular. And I really misunderestimated, to borrow a mangled phrase, that the surge would continue to keep giving. And what we're seeing now is a true product of the Bush surge, because, you know, compounded by the failings of the Maliki government, which further marginalized the Sunnis who had been in power in Iraq, they said, you know, we're striking out on our own. And I think that, you know, really they should take credit that the so-called surge, which wasn't quite a psychological operation, but was a propaganda operation, that it really is one of the origins of the current monster that we are now pledged to slay.
But again, I mean, I think we have to situate that in its historical context as well, given the, again, the documented admissions of the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, P2OG, which was specifically designed to, quote, launch secret operations aimed at stimulating reactions among terrorists and states possessing weapons of mass destruction. which, of course, I mean, then we get the British Special Forces operation soldiers dressed up in turbans and driving around in Iraq, planting bombs that get caught and then get busted out of jail by tanks on the U.S. side. And then, of course, we have the bombing of the Golden Mosque and other such deliberately provocative acts, which time and time again can be sourced back to these covert operations that were launched, I think, as part of an ongoing operation to stimulate the exact type of ethnic and racial and religious tensions that we see driving Iraq apart at the seams right now. And we would be naive to think that that wasn't the goal all along, to split Iraq up into warring factions. factions, to keep them at each other's throats, to keep them divided in order for, well, a number of different geostrategic purposes, but one of which, obviously, more easily controllable resources and control over the operations of the divided and fractured governments that are now increasingly becoming the real government of Iraq. I mean, I think the government of Iraq was mostly in name only for the last several years, and it's really becoming an on-the-ground reality now that it really is dividing up into three warring factions.
Yeah, and going back to how we opened up the conversation, I mean, it sounds like what you're describing is Gladio B to a T. This is what it's designed to produce. And even though I guess we don't have documented proof to show that this is exactly what's going on, just based on what we see, what we can observe, it fits the bill pretty well. And in fact, you know, it seemed like to me it was fairly obvious that the purpose of this latest aggression to go after this, you know, existential threat of the ISIS is now presenting. It seemed like the perfect sort of backdoor to once again go into Syria and overthrow Assad. And yet, lately, I've seen a couple of stories, more than a couple actually. It's a whole another narrative being built around the idea that Assad is actually welcoming these bombings. I want to get your perspective on this, gentlemen. I saw a story out of Vox.com by Max Fisher. Congratulations, Assad. You successfully got the U.S. to bomb your enemies instead of you. And it goes on to sort of talk about the idea that Assad is actually on this. We're on Assad's side here, and this is a good thing for him and his government to be dropping bombs in his country. What do you guys think about that?
Go ahead, James.
Well, my take on this is, I mean, obviously there has been explicit mentions by people in the Obama administration that, of course, we're going to have to bomb both sides, to be fair. We're going to have to bomb against Assad as well. So I think that's just going to be a later stage of this, the strikes that we see going on, and they're already talking about that. But, I mean, the idea that this is somehow in the service of Assad, in terms of short-term strategic goals, I suppose perhaps you could see it that way. But in terms of the bigger picture, it's the question of who has funded, fostered, trained, equipped, armed, literally brought these groups into the positions that they're in. It has been the U.S. in conjunction with the Gulf states, in conjunction with Turkey, in conjunction with Israel, in conjunction with all of the groups that have been documented to have been sending in arms, funds, and training, including, of course, the now documented and admitted and exposed training camp that was operating just over the border with Jordan for the last couple of years that BoilingFrogsPost.com broke in late 2011, and the MSM finally decided to reveal to the world in the beginning of 2013, at which the CIA, in conjunction with those Gulf states and some of those other partners, were training the very fighters that, lo and behold, became the Islamic State. So, I think we have to see the bigger picture here. And if you look at that tiny little bit of the picture, yeah, I suppose it's in favor of Assad that now that some of these bombs are dropping on his enemies. But who put his enemies there in the first place, I think, is the more important question.
I'd offer three general comments. One is I just wrote down blowback squared. And what we're seeing is compounded blowback from the covert operations, some of which may have been successful that we probably don't know about, and many of which have failed in the last, pick your time period, 10 or 20 years. Secondly, what Obama has attempted to articulate is a fully incoherent and illogical approach to this situation. Because let's assume just for a moment that IS is as evil and barbaric as the propaganda makes it out to be. Well, what happens when we vanquish them with necessarily boots on the ground? It's not going to happen simply from airstrikes. But my bet is that after the November elections, Obama, a full lame duck, will do whatever he wants, and any pledges, you know, not to put troops in will be as well remembered as the pledges about Afghanistan. But, you know, if we're successful, then do we leave Assad in place, or do we blow him out too and create the next Libya? And can the region stand a failed state, not for the purposes of staging terrorist attacks on the West, but just in terms of any coherence in the region? And I have argued that my big fear is that this vacuum creates a regional conflict that can widen if China and Russia really come off the sidelines in this particular fight. So my concern is that no one is talking about the true cost of this, the length of time it will take, and the what-ifs of what we do if we actually succeed. And, of course, I find it hard to believe we'll succeed. These are people who are very committed, and our very response to them elevates their status and makes the whole effort, you know, more likely to continue and more likely in an asymmetrical way to damage and degrade the true network of death here, which is coming from my taxpayer dollars.
You know, it's funny you should say that, Peter, because actually I was listening to NPR the other day, and I forget who the person was that was being interviewed, but I think you know what it was. It was people within the British Parliament, and they were going through the motions of a little dog and pony show to vote whether or not they should go ahead and join in on the bombing. And of course, it was the vast majority were on board. A few dissenters, but that was the argument. That was the what they were saying was that even if we accept the fact for the moment, you know, we the three of us were to accept the idea that ISIS is a legitimate threat, that they are a homegrown terrorist you know, faction or what have you. This is all on the up and up, and they're legitimately going to try and attack the United States and raise a flag over the White House or whatever they're saying these days. Even if we take that at face value, then what they were saying, it made sense within that context, was, well, if we respond to these beheading videos, to this propaganda that they're putting out, if we go ahead and bomb them, isn't this exactly what they want? Isn't this exactly, wouldn't this, you know, what you, as you just said, wouldn't this build them up as opposed to bringing them down? So again, within that framework, that made sense. And it's unfortunate that that's the only voices of dissent we have within, I guess, the major political sphere. Although I suppose I can't imagine any other way that would be put forth. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. I forget where exactly I was going with that, but I was trying to say.
At least the British got something passing for debate. Our dogs and ponies don't even show up and are just looking at the polls saying, you know, I've got to win re-election on November 4th, and this is not helpful. Hmm. And so, you know, all of the American political leaders are running away from this, further cementing the expanded powers of the executive to wage war, to launch new conflicts at will, completely unchecked, even by the financial aspect. You know, the Republicans were also worked up about the deficit and how we can't do this, we can't do that because of the deficit. And nobody's saying you can't bomb in Syria because we can't afford it.
Exactly right. And I think the social engineers are obviously looking at this successful operation to engineer a bombing of a country that they've obviously wanted to go into for some time now. And let's just cast our mind back 1 year to the alleged chemical weapons fiasco in Syria that ended up being proven by MIT and others to have launched from rebel-held areas, not the government-held areas that was originally being used. And of course, that ended up fizzling out when there was a huge amount of protest against the American involvement and British involvement in going in there on the basis of those chemical weapons claims. But then fast forward a year and suddenly the operation is a stunning success because of this Islamic State propaganda that we've seen basically trying to put that over on the American people. So there is a lesson that has been learned here. It's that if you try to maybe stage some sort of chemical weapons attack, something vaguely over there that we don't really know much about, people will protest. But if you put a turban boogeyman on the screen and say he's coming to get you, people will go for it. And maybe that's the fundamental difference and something that's been learned and will probably be used in the future, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, if at first you don't succeed, try again is the motto, I suppose, that they're living by. What happened to Hands Off Syria, guys? That was a little over a year ago. That was a relatively sizable campaign given the anti-war scene in the States lately. Anyway, that was as sizable as it's gotten in quite some time. And yet, a year later, everyone sort of just forgot about it once they had a boogeyman to fear.
Well, and I won't even press the limited attention span to a year. Let's go back 90 days to the Yazidis, all right? We were told that this was a humanitarian catastrophe that could not be handled by the Maliki government or anyone in the region. And no one but the U.S. could rescue these hapless people who had been driven to a barren mountain. That was the pretext that kind of paved the way for the wider attacks into Syria now. And they're all but forgotten. That whole string or meme is just now part of background noise.
Good point.
That's absolutely the case. And I want to point people to a very interesting editorial take from CBC News, of all places, by Neil MacDonald, the senior Washington correspondent for the CBC, who has been writing a series of increasingly interesting editorials lately, really going against some of the sort of mainstream interpretations of a lot of these events. And unfortunately, I can't seem to find the operative article at the moment, so I won't be able to reference it by name, but hopefully I can dig it up and put it in the show notes. But he had an interesting take about the difference between, for example, what is happening in the Congo is completely and utterly papered over in deference to what's happening in Syria. And he did an interesting contrast between the two, the responses of the Obama administration to different humanitarian crises, one that is arguably much, much larger in the Congo. But of course, Obama administration officials will happily appear with photo ops with the members of in power in the Congo and continue to, support militarily, financially, and otherwise some of the atrocities that are happening there. So once again, I mean, places like in Africa and other places that are less on the geopolitical radar can be completely and utterly basically ignored, while of course all attention is focused on the sort of boogeyman of the week. And unfortunately, that's nothing new, and it shouldn't have to be pointed out, but it still is, important to make those cases to all of these people who are suddenly claiming to be so worried about the Syrian people. But of course, I mean, again, just like Kony 2012 or any number of phenomena in recent years, we can see the public can be easily led, even based on misinformation, faulty information, incomplete information, to supporting military actions against parts of the world that they don't understand and that they have no genuine interest in. It's just sort of the flavor of the week that parades through the news. And it is really depressing to see how effective those types of campaigns can continue to be on influencing public opinion.
The other element here is the shifting definitions of barbarism that are defined by Western leaders. And I guess it's obligatory to say that I am not pro-decapitation. But a death in a war situation, the killing of a hostage, the torture of an individual leading up to their death is something that the United States is very good at. And we have increasingly employed these barbaric tactics against our presumed enemies. And yet we think somehow that we are immune to their use against our people, and that we can still summon massive outrage at the beheading of Jim Foley and some others, when Saudi Arabia, routinely beheads people as part of their authoritarian discipline. We haven't stopped torturing people at Guantanamo. The use of this force feeding system is as barbaric, I would argue, as a slow death from torture. And we're able to summon outrage when it's properly targeted, but we have no sense of self-criticism or self-reflection in the same barbaric zone.
Yeah, not even a hint of cognitive dissonance. That's a powerful thing, this propaganda. It's funny, but that's a really good point, Peter. Yeah, you're absolutely right on. That, you know, we can do all the same thing. Like, America doesn't torture. We don't call it torture, but, you know, when they do it, when those other guys do it, then we have to go after them because they're bad guys. They're bad people.
Well, it's not lost on me that the IS propagandists put Foley in an orange jumpsuit.
Oh, and, sure. Yeah.
They say that they waterboarded him. You know, whether it's true or not, they're using these tactics in ways that certainly resonate outside the United States, but are very effectively filtered when received by the homeland audience.
Should we get into that a little bit? I mean, it's probably worth discussing at least a bit. Those videos themselves, the legitimacy of the videos. I guess at this point, I'm assuming the three of us would agree that there was some amount of staging going on at the very least. And, you know, obviously, you know, the site group and where these videos are being coming streaming through or coming through. This is all very curious, because is the soft word that I can use to describe that. What do you guys think? I mean, obviously, I mean, I talked a little bit about this on a previous podcast myself, is James Foley specifically. And oh, God, goodness, the second name escapes me now. Maybe one of you can help me out with it. Sodorov? Is that close? Did I get that right? I think it's close enough, right?
Sounds about right.
Okay, let's go with that one. well, no, with their connections to this other interesting character of Matthew Van Dyke, who is a journalist, but not really a journalist, but sometimes he's a journalist. It's all very curious, and how especially Foley had absolutely no journalistic background prior to being embedded with the U.S. Army, which is very, very unusual. So anyway, a lot of little curious things with the story. Wondering if you guys want to offer some thoughts on that.
Well, again, I mean, I think we have to understand these videos for what they are, which is an attempt to motivate and sway public opinion. I mean, regardless of whether you believe they're real or staged or what have you, they are an attempt to sway public opinion. Sure. And in that regard, they've been remarkably successful. And I think one of the sort of propagandistic ways that these videos function is, as I was listening to the Revelations Radio News podcast, and they were discussing some of the sort of effect of these videos. And one of the hosts, Tim Kilkenny, was discussing how he encountered people in his daily life that he'd tried to talk to that would approach him about the videos and say, did you see this? They've beheaded this guy. We've got to go in and get them. And he would engage them by actually saying, well, did you actually watch the video? Did you notice how, for example, they cut out, they didn't even show the beheading. And then, you know, they come back with a still picture of what we're asked to believe is the beheading and blah, blah, blah. And when he tried to engage these people in that, they'd be like, oh, you actually watched that? You're sick. I mean, the point of these videos is that most people aren't going to seek them out. Yeah. Most people aren't going to look at them. They're just going to hear the headline, oh, this guy's been beheaded, let's go get them. And that was particularly underlined in the British context by the fact that I believe it was Scotland Yard said that anyone who actually tries to look at this video may be a terroristic activity.
Beheaded themselves, yeah. No.
Exactly. You may be suspicious if you're actually trying to seek out this video. So, I mean, it's remarkably effective for the vast majority of people who won't look at this, who won't look into it, who won't read past the headline. People who are, I mean, this is being aimed at the lowest sort of level of the media spectrum, which is the people who just get their news from occasional headlines or blurbs that they might see in passing on a newspaper or something like that, but people who will not look into it. And in that regard, it's remarkably effective. It doesn't even have to be remotely convincing as an actual piece of media, because most people won't even look at it.
Well, and yes, most people rely on received information and allow others to frame it for them. And for show and tell today, I wanted to recommend a book. It was published in 2013, but I just became aware of it recently. And it's written by a professor from Florida State named Lance DeHaven Smith. And it's called Conspiracy Theory in America. And he does a very good job of sketching, starting with the Kennedy assassination, which is the most widely accepted conspiracy theory package in recent American history, and moves forward. He's a little gingerly about some of the things he's willing to weigh in on, but to his credit, he does include 9/11 as what he calls a state crime against democracy. And by shifting the terminology from conspiracy theory, which he shows, and there's a CIA memo that introduced or launched conspiracy theory as a pejorative back in 1967, because there were too many people like me who were not accepting the word and work of the Warren Commission about the Kennedy assassination. And so at that point, they, using friendly media figures, they launched this very well thought out effort to demonize people who ask questions about conspiracies that are likely to have been spawned by our government. And so by shifting to the terminology of state crimes against democracy, it takes away this onus that is very clear. It's pretty high voltage, actually, that you cannot consider alternate theories. You cannot challenge the official narrative. You cannot express ordinary skepticism about things that are clearly untrue. And so we've created a mindset in the United States where the real dangerous groupthink is to not think at all, and to not use the powers that we have to challenge these things that are presented to us often in neat packages with slick production values. And it compounds, as I referred to earlier, this blowback squared, where we keep building sandcastles based, for example, on the mythology of 9/11.
Well, a couple of things to say in that regard. First of all, of course, you do point out to that CIA document that we will link in the show notes that in 1967, as you say, introduces the idea of using conspiracy theory as a pejorative, and others have done the LexisNexis type searches to prove that that suddenly became a very much used term in a lot of the media after that point.
And James, let me just interrupt to identify, it's CIA dispatch 1035-960, and I can send you a link to where it appears to be available online.
Yes,
excellent,
yes.
Excellent.
And so, I do have that linked up on Corbett Report already, but we will put that in the show notes. But of course, that dates back to 1967, but of course, for those with a shorter attention span, again, we can prove this from much more recent events, talking about Gary Webb, who there is now a movie coming out, Kill the Messenger, talking about the Gary Webb story, breaking the story back in the 1990s of how in the 1980s, the cocaine import agency known as the CIA helped to bring in the cocaine as a way of funding their Nicaraguan Contra operations. And of course, that led to the crack epidemic. And now, of course, we do have the CIA documents coming out proving that the CIA worked with as many as 17 different journalists to smear the name of Gary Webb and to basically call his work conspiracy theory, even though none of it was actually disproven. And in fact, internal CIA investigations and hearings that were held actually proved that, yes, so we kind of did allow some of this to go on under our noses. That was quickly swept under the rug. So, again, the destruction of Gary Webb's career and ultimately his suicide by two gunshots to the back of the head ends up being, unfortunately, another sad reminder of how this continues to operate. And in regards to the idea of state crimes against democracy as a sort of counter to that conspiracy theory label, it's interesting to note, for people who didn't catch it, I believe back in 2010, Project Censored, or maybe it was 2011, Project Censored, including Mickey Huff and director Peter Phillips, attempted to publish an article talking about how 9/11 was a state crime against democracy. And they were attempting to do this through the auspices of something called the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive think tank based in Washington, D.C., that had a deal to syndicate their columns in a number of different places. And it was the very first column that they had agreed to between Project Censored and the IPS. They were going to work together to publish some of these columns. The very first one they submitted was this 9/11 as a state crime against democracy article. And wouldn't you guess it? It was censored. They did not actually end up running it. So Project Censored was censored attempting to even bring this idea to the public's attention, which shows, again, I think, how dangerous these ideas are to the existing power structure.
So I have a question for the two of you actually on this net before we go any more detailed into the actual specifics here, because I have just a general question I want to throw out to both of you and to the audience actually, because I'm actually very, very curious about this. Now that we know that the term conspiracy theory was developed by the CIA as a pejorative, that it was a very tactical sort of thing that they did, is that a phrase that we ought to disassociate from? Is that something that we ought to then perhaps subvert? I know, James, you did this famously with your 9/11 video on the subject, the conspiracy theory, subverting that phrase once again and sort of turning it on its head a little bit. Not a little bit, a lot of it. But in other words, is this we talked about this a little bit also in a previous roundtable, the word truther as a pejorative. Is that something we ought to disassociate from or claim it or subvert it, or what should the strategy be here? In other words, is that something you guys have given any thought? And also, I'd like to hear, again, we always try to question the audience a little bit at the end to get their input. And this is something I'm genuinely very curious what all of you think about this. So you guys, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I am a pretty stubborn guy, and I don't like to submit to the language abuse that others engage in. I still call myself a liberal, even though that's been out of fashion since the Reagan era. And, I don't think that you can really make it unstick. So I prefer to challenge people when they say, oh, you don't believe the official story about 9/11. You're a conspiracy theorist. And, as many people have pointed out, the package that is generally accepted is a bunch of loosely strung together conspiracy theories that don't hold water or even catch fish. I think that we're not really going to open that many minds by trying to embrace it.
I fear that you are correct about that. But again, my initial reaction would be to say we should ignore it. Why adopt that terminology? Why engage with it? It is clearly just a weapon that's been implanted in people's minds. But unfortunately, it is so prevalent and so effective to get a lot of people to stop questioning or to simply stop listening to a lot of things that I think it does have to be addressed and probably in a head-on way, which is why I think probably the most effective way of doing that is, as you point to, Guillermo, my most popular video was the one where I kind of took that label and tried to flip it on its head and show it for the absurdity that it is. And I think laughing at this can be an effective way of getting the people, the types of people who are susceptible to this phrase, getting them to actually look at it. And on that note, I guess I'll open the kimono a little bit. I'm actually working on an eye-opener that I hope to release next week that's going to be entitled Shut Up, Conspiracy Theorist, and we'll address this in again, hopefully a humorous and interesting way that will get people to question it. I think, unfortunately, I mean, just given what we do, it's one of the things that we have to keep returning to, because I know in my own limited experience here in Japan talking to people that not so much with the Japanese public, who don't care about a lot of these events, to be honest, but with a lot of the expats that I talk to, it's something that comes up right away when you start talking about this. Oh, conspiracy theory.
Yeah. A couple of quick follow-ups regarding Gary Webb. James, you referenced the fact that journalists were recruited to take him down. And in particular, this goes back to when newspapers were actually owned by families. But the LA Times was the centerpiece of the attacks on Gary Webb. And that was still owned by the Chandler family at the time. And they were in a very ego-driven struggle with the family that owned the Mercury News. And the Mercury News was a more profitable newspaper in California at the time because Craigslist and online recruiting had not hit. And the Mercury News made fat profits every week from the job advertising placed by tech companies in the Valley. And so this was that, and at that time it was the Ritter family, Knight Ritter, that owned the Mercury. And the LA Times took great pleasure in trying to bring down this paper from a smaller market that was more successful and more profitable than the big old LA Times. Secondly, to Project Censored, I just wanted to share a brief anecdote. In 2006 or 2007, the media reform group called Free Press held a national conference, and they rented a booth to Project Censored. And Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff were there, and they were asking people to sign on to a petition to the claim that we were having a truth emergency and that the media was responsible and that activists needed to take this on. And it was not a secret that they were linking it to the false stories of 9/11. And so the organizers of this progressive media reform group came and just crashed down on Project Censored and said, cut this out. There's a Fox News team here. If they get a hold of this, we're all going to be painted as truthers. And these are people who I respect, and I will name names, John Nichols and Bob McChesney, both who have done great work on a number of important subjects. But when it came to this, they crumbled. They would not stand tall and even say, we don't agree with Project Censored, but we support their First Amendment right to express that. Instead, they were worried about the optics and they shut them down.
It's that's the fundamental driving psychology of so much of this is the optics. It's how will this look to other people? Oh, will they be able to portray us as crazy? And that's why conspiracy theory is such an effective term, because people don't want to associate with anything that could be classed that because they're afraid of social rejection.
Exactly.
Because they've been taught that these ideas are out there and they will be part of the outside group if they go with it. So it's so much, it plays on that fundamental insecurity that most people have. And it's, again, remarkably effective for that. But I guess we don't have to worry so much about the era of family-owned newspapers anymore, because we've entered the era of billionaire-owned newspapers. And billionaires won't be swayed by advertising dollars. So I guess we're in a much fairer media environment now.
Yeah. No problem with that at all. Yeah.
Carlos Slim, the actual owner of the New York Times, has driven new cost-cutting there. They've announced today that 100 reporter positions will be eliminated, and you can just imagine how many stories, how many beats, how many important, sources of information will no longer be accessed because of that major cutback at what is unfortunately the last big national paper in the country.
Or how many important stories like the NSA spying story they'll be able to cover up for a year for political purposes like they did back in 2005. But, oh, well.
Yeah.
And on that note, that sounds like a wrap-up.
Yeah, I'm out of things to ask you guys. So, yeah, unless either of you have anything else that you'd like to add or anything, I don't know. Usually we have at least a story or two on beard related news, but we may have fallen short on that this week again. I know I did, so no worries if you don't.
I totally forgot.
Yeah, so did I.
I totally forgot. But we'll look right now. What is trending with regards to beards?
In the
justice
meantime,
is to debate prisoners' religious right to grow a beard.
Talk for
tips
1 minute.
And tricks to look after your beard from the Sydney Morning Herald.
What was that?
How to grow a hipster beard by the Cherry Hill Courier Post.
That's good.
BYU students fight for the right to grow beards from Think Progress.
There you go.
You know, beards are such a trending topic.
Really
there's never
is.
Any shortage of stories.
Well, I will say this, though. I like always, like to invite the audience to send us their questions, their comments, anything else they'd like us for us to talk about. I would like to hear from them specifically on the conspiracy theory thing. I think that's really gonna inspire a lot of comments on that note. But anything else, again, you guys out there listening, have on your minds with regard to anything we talked about or anything at all for that matter, send them our way. We'll have the links to each of our contact pages on the show notes for this podcast. Peter, you had something to add?
Yeah, I ran across the room and grabbed this. Okay. It's gone viral, and it appeared to be originally a letter to the editor to a British newspaper. And the headline reads, "Clear as mud. Are you confused by what's going on in the Middle East? Let me explain. We support the Iraqi government in the fight against Islamic State. We don't like IS, but IS is supported by Saudi Arabia, whom we do like. We don't like President Assad in Syria. We support the fight against him, but not IS, which is also fighting against him. We don't like Iran, but Iran supports the Iraqi government against IS. So some of our friends support our enemies, and some of our enemies are our friends. And some of our enemies are fighting against our other enemies, whom we want to lose, but we don't want our enemies who are fighting our enemies to win. If the people we want to defeat are defeated, they might be replaced by people we like even less. And all this was started by us invading a country to drive out terrorists who weren't actually there until we went in to drive them out. Do you understand now?"
Makes perfect sense. Yeah. We've always been at war with Eurasia. What can I say? Anyway, again, big thanks to those of you who are out there listening and tuning in this month. We'll be back next month, of course. And as always, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Big thanks to you for doing this. Peter B. Collins, The Peter B. Collins Show, and Processing Distortion on BowlingFrogsPost.com. That's it for this time. Come back again next month here on the Beard World Order.
You should reject these voices.
I want to say this to the television audience.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society.
You are free to do as we tell you.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Well, we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
The Beard World Order.